Have you ever had an experience where you were on the same page but in a different playbook with someone around you, and you were kind of talking past each other in the process as you did that? A couple months ago, maybe it's almost a year ago maybe now, my wife asked me if I would go to the store to pick up some tissue. And so, because I'm the best husband in the world, I was like, oh my gosh, I was hoping you would ask me. So yeah, hello. And so I went to Target or Walmart or wherever was around me. And I got one of those big, you know, like, you can't buy, like, one box of Kleenex. It's like, you can buy 4 or 4 million, you know. So I bought, like, you know, one of those big packages of them and brought them home. And she wasn't home, which is a real disappointment because I couldn't walk through the door. You know, some guys, like, they carry, like, the deer head, you know, through the door or whatever. I got, like, my Kleenex, you know, I brought in. And so I brought it in. I just put it in our linen closet in the bathroom and figured, you know, when we need tissue, we'll know where to go, you know. And so later on, she came in. She was like, hey, did you get that tissue that I asked you for? And I said, yeah, it's in the linen closet. And she said, well, I opened up the linen closet, and all I saw was Kleenex. And I was like, yeah, tissue. You know? And so that's when I learned that my marriage was heading for divorce right away because I, like a normal person, call tissue Kleenex. And my wife thinks that tissue is something that goes on your toilet paper roll, which we all know that's toilet paper, right? So I quick poll, who says that's toilet paper? Who calls that toilet paper? Okay, who says, yeah, see, that's correct. So people who are going to listen to this later on online are going to be so confused about what just happened in this room right here. Thank you so much for allowing me to sleep on the couch tonight. You've been very helpful. So sometimes we talk past each other. We don't, you know, we're on a different page on different things, and sometimes very important things like, you know, tissue paper and toilet paper. And today, what I want to talk about, I think, is something that qualifies in that image for us. We're in this journey to try and understand, how do we love people well? How do we love people better? Because Jesus says the mark of his followers is that we would love well. And we've been looking at this passage of scripture. It comes from 1 Corinthians chapter 13. A guy named Paul wrote these words many, many moons ago, where he said, love is patient, love is kind, it doesn't envy, it doesn't boast, it isn't proud, it does not dishonor others, it's not self-seeking, it's not easily angered, and it keeps no record of wrongs. Love doesn't delight in evil, but it rejoices with the truth. Last week, we talked about how love always protects and always trusts. And this week, we move on to this word, that love always hopes. And hope is the very specific word that I feel like we often talk past each other on. Hope is a key component of love. Hope is a critical element of what it means to love others and to love people well. Hope, if you Google that online, what you're going to discover is that hope, I think when we say that word in our culture, what we usually mean is optimism. And what we usually mean is positivity. And those are good things. I'm not here to tell you you shouldn't be positive and that sort of thing. But I think that's different. And if you Google it, what you're going to see images of, like, the flower bursting through the crusty, dry ground. And you're going to see, you know, like the mountain with the rainbow. And you're going to see the road with a big, bright light at the end of the roadway. You're going to see all these images. They feel like they should be on some sort of motivational poster or something. And that's great. But if hope is just optimism, what that means is it still relies on me, doesn't it? It relies on me and my aptitude and my ability to be able to somehow crank out that optimistic feeling that I need in order to remain hopeful, to remain steadfast, to remain whatever it is I'm trying to be in any given moment. And I don't know about you, but usually the moments when I need to be the most hopeful are the moments I also struggle and find myself unable to do that the most, which is where I think God chirps in and chimes in, because the biblical vision of hope is a lot different, I think, than mere optimism, or a mere, I'm going to have a positive spirit about this circumstance or about this situation. When we think about hope from a biblical standpoint, this is a whole big idea today. If you take nothing else, I want you to grab this today, is that hope is trusting God's power in the midst of my powerlessness. Hope is trusting God's power in the midst of my powerlessness. There are three key elements there. Number one, it's trust. Right? It's a decision. It's a choice. It's an investment of my confidence in something or someone. It's an investment, it's a trust, it's a choice I make when I feel powerless, right? When I feel unable to do something or experience something or find something on my own, that's when hope becomes important. I don't wake up in the morning and think to myself, man, I hope I can make coffee this morning. You know, like I had that, okay? I didn't wake up today and think, you know, as I was like getting ready to get in the shower and go, man, I hope I am able to adequately clean my body and be a hygienic person, okay? I was like, man, I got this. I've done this at least 10 times in my life before. I know I can do this, okay? I did not need hope for that situation because I kind of had the adequate power to be able to do that. But we have a lot of situations where we do not have the power to be able to do something. And that's where hope becomes key. And that's where the third part comes in. It's not just trust. It's not just trust when I'm hopeless or powerless. It's trusting in God's power when I feel powerless. It's trusting that the same God who rose his son from the dead, the same God that that was able to, you know, create this world, the same God that, as we're going to read later on, does miracles, that if he can do all that stuff, I can feel pretty good about my possibility of being able to know that he's still at work and still can do stuff today. And I kind of say this all the time, but hey, Jesus called his own death and resurrection, and they pulled it off a couple days or weeks later. And if you can do that, I just want to let you know, I'm in the tank for you and for whatever it is you're selling, okay? I'm just going to sign up for your thing because that's it. And hope, another way to think about this, is hope is rooted in something beyond ourselves, which is precisely why I think the biblical vision of hope, why God's vision of hope for our world is so powerful, because it's not just something that relies on me. It actually works whether I feel like I'm up to the task or not. It's rooted in something that goes beyond me. It's rooted in something, in someone bigger than me and greater than me and better than me, which is precisely what makes it powerful and precisely what makes it a big deal. I've gave a lot of thought this week to the idea of hope, because when I think about my relationships, I don't usually think about hope being a really big part of them. And I think that's true for a lot of our day-to-day relationships, but I think we find ourselves needing to lean on hope in relationships in two situations. We find ourselves leaning on hope when we are praying and desiring change in a relationship, and maybe kind of related to that, we find ourselves leaning on hope when we know a relationship is pretty hopelessly broken. And in those moments, hope becomes an incredibly important part of love. Because what I have experienced in my life, both on the receiving end and sadly on the giving end of this, is that in the relationships in my life that aren't the way I wish for them to be, seldom is the case, man, you know what? We were really messed up, and then Wes gave up on me, and man, that was like the wind beneath my wings, you know? Like, that's not how it works, right? Seldom do we feel like people give up on us, and the relationship gets better. It might, you know, it happens once in a blue moon, but I think one of the reasons we notice it so much when that happens is precisely because it's so rare, you know, that when we give up on other people, they end up usually giving up on us. And the funny thing about the human condition is we have this weird way of sort of living up to or down to people's expectations and treatment of us. And if you treat me like, hey, there's no hope, you're kind of trash, you know, guess what I often become? I become kind of a trashy person, right? And likewise, when you have this inspiring vision for me, even when I don't see it in myself, there's this strange hope-giving, inspiring quality to that, isn't there? And some of you have a story in your past where you were kind of down in the dumps, you know, you were struggling, and you met a coach. You met a significant other, or who may now be a spouse. You know, you met your parents in that moment, or a teacher in that moment, or a friend in that moment, and they saw the gold in you when you didn't think there was any gold to be seen inside of you. And that hope that they invested in you lifted you to a brand new place. It lifted you out of addiction. It lifted you out of that rough, broken-hearted relationship. It lifted you out of just that dark, depressing time in your life. It lifted you out of that mental health thing that you were walking through. Whatever the case may be, hope has an incredibly powerful influence on love. And so today, here's what I want us to do, is I want us to look at a story that Jesus told. I guess he didn't tell it, actually. He lived it. John, one of his first century followers, writes it down for us. John is like standing right next to Jesus as all this stuff happens. And later on in the first century, you know, about 50 years or so after Jesus, you know, rose from the dead and went back up into heaven, John decides, well, gosh, I'm an old dude. I better write all this down so it doesn't, you know, die with me one day. And so he writes down this biography of Jesus' life that he hands to us called the Gospel of John. And in the Gospel of John, we have this story about Jesus where Jesus encounters this guy. And the reason I want us to read this story together today is because I think that this guy is just a perfect picture of like hopelessness and what it looks like to be pretty hopeless. And Jesus turns his life around, and it's actually not just that. I kind of gave away the end of the story, I guess, right here. I'm sorry, Jesus is going to do a miracle at the end. Surprise! Yeah. It's actually, I think for me at least, the way he does this miracle and what he says about it afterwards that to me is so inspiring and so hope-giving. And I think we can learn a little bit from together this morning. So John chapter 5, verse 1, here's what John writes for us. Sometime later, Jesus went up to Jerusalem for one of the Jewish festivals. So party time in Jerusalem, hanging out there. And now there is in Jerusalem, near the Sheep Gate, a pool. This is like the equivalent of John writing like, so if you go up Capitol Circle and you make a left and you turn onto Miccosukee, okay, you're going to get there. And over there is this pool, which in Aramaic was called Bethesda. And it was surrounded by five covered colonnades, by five kind of big porches that are around there. Here, a great number of disabled people used to lie, the blind, the lame, and the paralyzed. Now, it is really, really hard for us to imagine a place like this one, because we don't really have this in America. But this is this whole section of Jerusalem that basically, if you have some sort of life-altering disease or problem or birth defect or you're paralyzed or you're blind or something other that just kind of makes your life hard and you don't really have any hope for healing or anything, you just kind of sit and you lay here. And we'll talk about why that was in just a second. But you just sit here. And I have to imagine this is the most hopeless place in the world. Okay, the only thing that even comes close is if you remember like the life of Mother Teresa, right? She would go to Calcutta and she would help like all these just injured and like people close to death and dying and care for them on the streets of India, right? Like that's the only thing in the modern world that I could imagine it's even close to what is they're experiencing here. And I have to imagine if I'm John, and you know, Jesus and my crew, we're cruising up into this place. Like, I'm kind of like, Jesus, what are we doing here, man? Like, my mom told me we don't go here. You know, like, this is super depressing, you know? It was super smelly. You know, these people probably had open sores and wounds, okay? They're lying in the hot Palestinian sun all day, okay? They're groaning because they're in pain, and this is a culture without both morphine and Old Spice, both of which would have been really important in this situation, okay? This is not a place you go just to, you know, hang out. You know, this is a place that you would avoid at all costs if you're someone like John or Matthew or Peter or one of Jesus' disciples. And so Jesus cruises up here, and they're like, oh, great, what are we doing? Jesus first was the tax collectors, now we're here. Oh, my gosh, okay. So then Jesus goes on. The story tells us that one guy was there who had been an invalid. We don't know what was wrong with him. We just know he was seriously weakened, couldn't move, something, you know, whatever's wrong with him. He'd been there for 38 years. So this guy is probably the most hopeless guy in the most hopeless place on the planet at this moment. Now, 38 years, it's easy for us just to read that as a little detail. I'm 31, okay, so he is West plus 7, okay? I looked it up this morning, and I just want to kind of set the mood for those of you. Half of you are not even going to know what this is, okay? But 38 years ago, 1981, okay, let me tell you, big songs that year, 9 to 5 came out that year, so Dolly Parton, okay? Endless Love, okay, Lionel Richie, okay, so some of you, you're going back to home, kind of like, my endless love, you know, that kind of thing. It ended with Olivia Newton-John sang a Physical, that was like, you know, ended the year as a chart topper, okay, so when that was not like, hey, I went to a wedding and this fun song came on, like, that was on the radio, and it was like the current hit, you know, like, that's how long this guy has been paralyzed, or weak, or whatever, he's sitting there, it's been a hate to tell you, long time, okay? They call him oldies for a reason now, all right? So this guy's been here. He's been, now, do you think that in this spot, this guy had sat here for 38 years and every day his head pops off the pill and he's like, maybe today's the day. You know, like, I gotta imagine somewhere along the way in 38 years, I become a little cynical, a little just resigned to this is the way my life is, a little, you might say, hopeless about my condition and my state, okay? Because that's what you do when you're in a culture where no one can help you and you're sick and you're next to a bunch of other sick people and you've been there for 4 decades, you start to feel a little hopeless. And so Jesus walks up to this guy. And we're told in the very next verse that when Jesus learned, he saw him lying there and learned he'd been in this condition for a long time, he asked him this such an off-putting question. Hey, do you want to get well? To which, I think this guy, you know, he probably said a few words I'm not allowed to say in church, right? You know, like, Jesus, of course I want to get well, right? But here's how the guy responds. Sir, the invalid replied, I have no one to help me into the pool when the water is stirred. Now, let me help you understand what's happening here. Bethesda, these pools, they were built on top of a natural spring, and they didn't know this back at the time, but what would happen is occasionally this natural spring would bubble up, and so, like, for no apparent reason, the surface of the water would, like, get bubbly and look like it had been stirred and that sort of thing, and so people 2,000 years ago thought an angel had come and, like, stirred the water, and this urban myth kind of grew that if you could be the first person who got into the water, you would be miraculously healed of whatever your thing is. We have no record of that ever happening. We just know that apparently that was a legend that had developed over this time. So this guy, literally, the reason he sat next to this pool for 38 years is in just the vaguest of hope that maybe one day when this water bubbles up, he might be able to be the first in and maybe, just maybe, might be able to find healing. What I think is really interesting is when Jesus says, would you like to get better, this guy's answer isn't, yes. It is, here's my excuse for why I can't. Here's the reason why I won't and probably never will. Jesus, I'm not there when the water gets stirred. And then he continues on, and second half of his statement he makes, he says, Jesus, like, no one's here to help me, right? Like, the water gets stirred and I can't get in. I'm not there in time. I need someone to help me out. And Jesus responds, and he just says, okay, well, get up. Pick up your mat and walk, right? Just like nonchalantly. He uses 8 words. And then John says at the end of the story, so the guy, you know, he got up and picked up his mat and he walked home, right? Once the man was cured, he picked up his mat and he walked. Jesus expended less effort to heal this guy than I did making my morning cup of coffee today. I had scrambled eggs for breakfast today. I used more effort to make those eggs than Jesus did to heal this guy, you know, from a disease or whatever it was that afflicted him for 38 years, okay? Here's what I want you to see about this is when Jesus is around, there is always hope, right? When the power of God is accessible to you, there is always a difference that can be made, okay? Jesus is talking to this guy. What is so ironic is this guy is staring the Son of God straight in the face, and yet he doesn't even recognize it. He's more hung up on, I can't get into this little pool, Jesus, not like, hey, could you help me out, brother? You know, can you help me out with this kind of thing? And I think so often we do that. We ignore Jesus. We ignore God. We ignore the power that is accessible and available to us because we get focused on the idea of whatever it is I've pinned my hopes on that isn't the power of God. And Jesus is kind of showing us, man, if you want to find a reason for hope, the reason for hope isn't you and isn't your circumstances and isn't your situation and isn't what's going on with you. It's in me. And so you need to look at me, right? The same guy that was able just to waltz in and go, hey, man, want to get better? Why don't you go ahead and just stand up? You know, like, that same God is still living and active and working today. And because he's living and active and working today, we can have hope in the most hopeless feeling of situations. Jesus does this miracle. The guy walks away. He doesn't even, like, get to know Jesus' name, right? Like, I don't know if he was, like, so excited as, like, oh, man, I got 38 years of walking to do, you know, or something like that. I got to get me a Fitbit, you know, something like that. And he just kind of walks around, okay? He walks away, he doesn't even know Jesus. But, of course, when this happens, a crowd forms around Jesus. And so Jesus speaks to them. And in John 5:17, he makes a statement that is so important. He says, my Father, God, is always at his work. He is always at work. He doesn't take a day off. Whether you see it or not, well, I, the Son of God, the only person who's been to heaven and can tell you about it, when he is at work, okay, he is always at work to this very day, and I too, just like my dad, I am working. I am up to something. Now, here's what Jesus doesn't say. He doesn't say, hey, God is always at work and you'll always see it. And he doesn't say, hey, God's at work and you're always going to notice it right away as it happens. What he says is, my Father is always at work. And just in case that wasn't enough for you, I am too. And so what I think Jesus is kind of sending us a secret little bat signal on this is, guys, if I'm always at work, there's always a reason for hope. There's always a reason to believe that things can change. There is always reason for you to trust in my power in the midst of your feeling powerless. And yes, that applies to hopeless situations that we feel like we encounter. I think that also, though, specifically today, that applies to your relationships. And that applies to your family. And that applies to your friendships, which are now former friendships, which you're hoping and praying every single day that they become your friendships again. Because hope is a component of love. Because a recognition that God's power is always at work behind the scenes, even when I don't see it, is a part of what love is. And there is always, 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 always a reason for hope. Now, what that doesn't mean is the relationship always looks the same. We talk about this all the time, right? What it doesn't mean is I can't put boundaries in place. You know, what it doesn't mean is I'm allowed, sometimes we do this in the church world where we kind of say, Jesus, I'm claiming this relationship, right? We just kind of make this blanket statement out in the air. It's like, oh, God's up in heaven. Like, oh, well, Cecilia said it, so I guess I'm in it now, you know, that kind of thing. Okay, that's not how this works. But what we can know is we can have hope. We can be hopeful in every situation because the power we are resting on and relying on isn't our power to change, and it's not their power to change. It is God's power to change. And with that power, there's always reason for hope. And in our lives, I feel like hope, that means a couple of things for our relationships. So here's the first thing. Hope means that I can forget about fixing others. Okay? I'm not saying the people in your life, the relationships in your life, they're broken, that you should just, you know, abdicate your influence, you should abdicate your leadership, okay? You should influence, you should lead, you should continue to show up and put effort in that relationship. But there's a difference, right, between doing that and then feeling like I've got to fix them. And I can't speak for anyone in this room, but I know I have a really healthy Messiah streak. Like, if Jesus ever has a sick day, don't worry, man, I'm going to step right in. You know, I feel more than happy just to try and, you know, bear the weight. And every time I do that, I find out, wow, that's a really stupid decision on my part, you know? And what I've also noticed is in relationships, no one's ever went, man, you know what, this relationship was bad. And then they started, that felt like I was their project, and that made it so much better. Right? No one likes to feel like a project. You don't want to feel like a project. I don't like feeling like a project. But yet we walk around and we feel like it's our responsibility to fix others. And if hope is trusting God's power in the midst of my powerlessness, what that means is I am freely admitting to God, God, I am powerless to fix this relationship. Like, I can only own my part, and even then I kind of struggle to own that sometimes, right? And God, I can't control their behavior. I can't fix them. I can't change inside them what needs to be changed. But God, I know you can, and I know you working through me that you can. And I know you working through other people in their lives and other circumstances and situations in their lives can. And so you know what, God? I'm going to forget about trying to fix them all the time. And the most amazing thing happens when you do that. A burden falls off of them, and the burden falls off of you. Because carrying the weight of having to fix another person is way too big for you and for them to bear. And hope says, God, I'm just going to entrust them to you, and I'm just going to do my best to kind of follow and intersect with their lives the way that you want me to. Okay, here's the second thing hope does. Hope, this might seem obvious, but hope believes change is possible. One of the phrases I try to eliminate from my vocabulary is, that's just the way it is. And we do this all the time with people when we say, well, that's just Marcus being Marcus. You know, oh, that's just Karen being Karen. That's just Jim being Jim, you know. And what we kind of say in that moment is usually, and they aren't going to change. It's always going to be this way. And hope, as elementary as it sounds, hope simply believes it doesn't always have to be this way. That we haven't hit the ceiling yet. That there really is a possibility of change and of growth. And that the relationship and the way it stands today, and they as they are today, and me as I am today, that there is possibility for it to change. Maybe not now, maybe not tomorrow, maybe not the next day, but in the future, that change is possible. Followers of Jesus should be the biggest believers in change because every single one of us has seen Jesus change us. And if Jesus can change us, how dare I say he cannot change another person? And that doesn't mean I'm naive. It doesn't mean I expect it. It doesn't mean I'm banking on it, right? But what it does mean is I believe it can happen. And when I interact with you or when I interact with them, that I do so having one hand firmly on the hope that I believe this can happen. And it's amazing how that oftentimes is the first step to change actually happening. Here's a third thing that hope does. Hope has a community. I think the guy in this story experienced a lot of unnecessary pain and heartbreak because the community of people around him were not hope-giving, they were hope-sucking. He surrounded himself for 38 years with a group of people who were equally hopeless, equally hurting, equally struggling, all that kind of stuff. And I cannot imagine that over the course of 38 years, that was soul-feeding for that guy. Hope dies in isolation. Hope dies when we surround ourselves with people who do not exude hope. We are so big on the idea of you getting into the community group or you serving or you just doing something, even if it's like a one-off thing, like hey, I'm going to go one of those tailgate parties or I'm going to sign up to help at the movie night thing. And the reason we're a big deal about that is because I want to put you in proximity with a hope-giving community. I want to put you in proximity with hope-giving people or at least take a tiny little eensy-weensy baby step toward it. Because oftentimes we're not really filled by the people around us, right? That we live in a hope-sucking kind of world that just leeches the hope out of us. And I think, kind of like that guy in the story, we wake up and we just find ourselves cynical, and we find ourselves bitter, and we find ourselves angry. And the reason we do is because we don't have a community around us. Guys, we're becoming more and more connected, yet more and more isolated than ever. Study after study after study shows us that, and it is having an emotional detriment on your soul, on my heart. And what I think this story shows us, and what I think the story of Scripture keeps showing us, is hope has a community. The church exists because God knows hope has a community. And we would do well to reach out to find it. Last thing hope does, hope remains open-minded about the results. Sometimes God's going to do a miracle in a relationship. Sometimes he's not. And I'm not smart enough to understand how our free will and God's sovereign will and all these kind of things intersect. That's a little above my pay grade, you know, right now. Maybe one day I'll understand that, but probably not. But what I do know is this, is hope remains open-minded and it doesn't hold God's feet to the fire on something he hasn't promised. And Jesus actually, later on in John's gospel, he's going to circle his followers up and he's going to say these words in John 15. He says, if you remain in me and my words remain in you, in other words, what I'm about ready to say to you guys is it hinges on this. It hinges on the idea that you're aligned with me, that you're committed to my will above your will, my kingdom above your kingdom, okay? Ask whatever you wish and it will be done for you. Jesus says, ask for the sun, moon, and stars if you want. Go big. You know, go big or go home. That was Jesus' idea when you talked to him, okay? We don't really like the part where it's like, in my will, you know, according to me, I kind of like the second half of that verse more than the first. But Jesus says, hey, ask it, go for it. And then he says, I want to tell you the prayer that God is always going to answer. He says, this is to my Father's glory. This makes my Father in heaven beam, smile, get excited. that you would bear much fruit. What Jesus says is, if you want to know the prayer that God always gets excited and amped up about answering, it's the prayer that results in you bearing fruit. And Jesus says this after a couple paragraphs earlier. He says the words that we started this series with, which are, hey, they will know you are my followers, they will know you are my disciples by the way that you love. And so he says, hey, God wants you to bear fruit, and he wants you to demonstrate yourselves. He wants to be able to show you, to present you as his disciples. And you can bet that God is always at work behind the scenes and in front of the scenes trying to orchestrate and make that happen. Sometimes that happens in a really amazing way. Last week I told you a story about this thing that was happening church-wise like 5 years ago, and it was a horrible mess and all this kind of stuff. And there was a guy, he was actually a teenager, who was in our church, and he was kind of affected by this change I was leading through, and his name was Ian. And Ian's, we started to roll out this change we were making with our student ministry, and Ian was just not interested. He was not having it. He was really angry. He was really upset. He didn't like transition. He had a lot of factors kind of happening. And Ian made it very clear, Wes, I'm done with you. I'm done with your church. I'm done with all this stuff, which, never feels good. It really doesn't feel good. And it's like, oh, good. I was hoping to crush a 16-year-old today. That made me feel really great on the inside, And honestly, I kind of written the relationship off. And one day, two years later, I get this random Facebook message from Ian asking, hey, can we get coffee? And I always hate messages. They're like, can we do this? And they have no reason attached because we hadn't really been talking or anything. I was like, oh, great. Yeah. Can't wait for you to chew me out, for an hour or whatever that's going to be over coffee. That's going to be really great, So I scheduled a meeting. I scheduled a meeting after the meeting. So if it went bad, 45 minutes later, I could be like, oh, man, I got to go, across town. So sorry. And so I got to this meeting. And I sat down, and Ian shared with me about this really big experience about how God just got a hold of him and changed his life. And he said, thank you so much for being a part of that, Wes, which I was like, oh, yeah, I thought it was the part of God, destroying your life, apparently. I'm very sorry, but, I'm glad to hear things are changing for you. That's really awesome. And he and I talked, and he had kind of an inkling of some things he wanted to do with his life. And now, a couple of years after that, Ian's 21 now, and he actually just got back a couple weeks ago from leading a discipleship training seminar in Vietnam and in East Asia, which, in case you're wondering, Vietnam is a country where you're not allowed to be a Christian. And so Ian, literally this kid who wanted nothing to do with Jesus 5 years ago, is now not just helping people learn to follow Jesus and provide leadership training to people following Jesus, but he's doing so in a country where it's illegal to do so, where he could be thrown into some, prison in Ho Chi Minh City or something like that. He's traveled halfway around the world. Every couple of months, Ian will reach out and we'll talk on the phone and I'll hear about what God's doing in his life, and he'll usually ask me a question or two, and hey, could you help me with this, or what would you do about that, or that kind of thing. And last time I got off the phone with him, I just thought, wow. God, I don't know what I saw coming 5 years ago, but I didn't see that coming. I love it when God answers my hope prayer that way. But God doesn't always answer my hope prayer that way. Sometimes he answers the prayer for hope in a relationship in a way that says, I want you to learn how to bear fruit. And what he does is he kind of puts, I think, relationships in our pathway where I have to learn the value of perseverance and persistence and hope. And where I run up against someone where my desire to want to fix them gets tested. And where my desire just to want to not be optimistic, but to be pessimistic, to be cynical, gets tested. And where I kind of want to isolate myself because I just can't figure it out and I don't want to ask for help and I don't want to do that thing gets tested. And where even to some degree, maybe my confidence in God gets tested, right? Because the answer isn't working out the way I want it to. Jesus' words, we read them earlier, but we'll read them again to close. Jesus' words are, my Father is always at work. And I too am working. And what that means is, even in the situations where I don't look back, where I don't have an Ian kind of moment, where I look and go, wow, God was obviously at work. Jesus says, I want you to know I'm working. With that paralyzed guy for 38 years, I was working. With that spouse, I'm working. With that coworker, I'm working. And whether you see it or not is not important. What is important is I'm asking you to place your confidence in me to know I'm working. I want you to have hope as a component of love, because hope is just a decision to place your confidence and your trust in my power to change things, in my power to make something different. Because I was at work then, and I'm still at work today. And don't you dare give up on someone when I haven't. Hope is a decision to trust in God's power in the midst of our powerlessness. It still works today. Jesus, thank you for your word to us and your reminder to us that you're always at work. You're always up to something. You're always doing something. And Jesus, I pray you would give us the wisdom that's necessary to know what to do with this message and what to do with your request for us to hope, for us to hold out hope even in relationships that feel and seem hopeless. Help us take a next step today. All of you right where you are, I want to ask you to join me in doing something. I want you to take your hands, if you would, and I just want you to clench them up in a fist and just hold them kind of tight against your chest like this. And together, I just want us to kind of, right now, feel that tension. And I just want us to kind of put down an act of surrender. And I want us to do this a couple times as we finish today. We're going to sing one last song of worship today. And as we do this, I just want us to practice having that posture of saying, God, this is what I do, right? God, hang on. I try to fix it. I try to change it. And God, you know what? I surrender. Let's just do that once or twice more. God, I'm holding on. I'm wrestling. I'm hanging on. And God, you're saying, surrender. God, I want to take it back. I want to wrest control from you. And God, you're saying to surrender. I heard once that the act of surrender, the act of open-handedness, that is the one behavior to release. It's the one thing that you have unlimited capacity to do. That you have the unlimited capacity just to continue to surrender. And I think it's because God has built that into us. His desire for us is not to live tense and clenched, it's to live surrendered. And as we sing this final song together, asking for God's love to wash over us and to shape us and to change us, maybe for you as we sing this song, you just need to live with, you know, sing with this posture of surrender. And to sing with this mindset, this physical action that represents a posture of our heart to say, God, I surrender.